Welcome to Vital Minds, a podcast series brought to you by the PA Foundation, the philanthropic arm of the American Academy of PAs. The PA Foundation's mission is to empower PAs to improve health through philanthropy and service. Join us as we connect the most vital issues in clinical care with the top minds who face them every day. We'll talk with PAs and other healthcare providers about disease diagnosis and treatment, patient interactions, and the critical care needs this profession provides to patients around the world. I'm James Millward, also a PA and your host for Vital Minds. Joining us on today's episode of Vital Minds is Dr. Roger McIntyre. Dr. McIntyre is currently a professor of psychiatry and pharmacology at the University of Toronto, the head of the Mood Disorders Psychopharmacology Unit at the University Health Network in Toronto, Canada, and director of the Depression and Bipolar Support Alliance in Chicago, Illinois. Dr. McIntyre is also involved in research endeavors, which aim to characterize the association between mood disorders, cognitive function, and medical comorbidity. In his research, he works to distinguish the underlying causes of cognitive impairment in patients with mood disorders and the impact of this impairment on workplace function. Roger, I'm thrilled to have you with us today as we take a closer look at the evolving field of mood disorders and behavioral health.
Well, thank you for having me. It's just a pleasure to join you today.
Now, let's jump right in, Roger. I know you do a ton of research in this field, but I thought we'd kind of break the ice with what comes to your mind when thinking of mood disorders and their impact specifically on functioning in the workplace.
What comes to mind right away for me is the thinking aspect of depression. And if I was to step back two steps, you know, I think all of us, when we actually open the newspaper in the morning time, we're hearing endless news reports about the job opportunities that are out there or the lack thereof. And a more sort of careful read of the articles, what emanates is that the skill sets that are being demanded in the by employers in the workplace are changing. And they're changing, for example, when compared to certainly 100 years ago, maybe even 30, 40 years ago. How are they changing? Well, they're changing towards a workforce that is putting increasing emphasis on what I call the cognitive or the complex human capital economy. In other words, there's more of a Silicon Valley want by employers. They want people who are well-educated, people who are able to participate cognitively in that workplace. And this is driven by many factors, well beyond psychiatry, automation, globalization, and so on. But how this impacts me, not just as an academic, as a clinician, but as an advocate, in this area, is that we know that diseases of the human brain that interfere with human cognitive function have implications for the workplace. So when I think about major depression or mood disorders broadly, I think about a disturbance in mood. Absolutely. It's one of the defining and essential features. In addition, where we haven't really shone the streetlight as much is on cognition. And that's so critical to the function, so critical to the quality of life, and so critical to the illness trajectory. So for me, it's not to be sort of put a pun on this, but it's thinking about cognition. And for me, that's a fundamental shift in how I approach this condition.
I like that, thinking about cognition. Now, let's get a little bit deeper into the clinical aspect of this. Are there particular signs of kind of mood disorder, cognitive dysfunction connection that our PA audience should be aware of when we are seeing patients? I mean, is there specific genetic markers or screening tools that you feel like are really useful for us?
You know, I think the most important source of information still today in psychiatry is not a tool, it's not a laboratory measure. It's really the good history from the patient. And the patient is providing that information. And I think when a patient who is in our office or in our clinical setting, who is saying to us, you know, I have a disturbance in my mood, I'm not enjoying life as much. But particularly when they say, I've got functional problems, you know, I'm whatever the job may be, and it doesn't need to be a job outside the home. They could be a homemaker, for example, a volunteer. They could have some other, you know, role as a student. Whatever their role is, just role function impairment. When they say to you they have this, what they're really in fact saying to you is, I've got something wrong with my cognitive abilities. And why I'm saying it so matter-of-fact like that is because the preponderance of the scientific evidence indicates that what's really in fact driving role impairment in depression is less their mood and more their cognition. So what I do is I assess the symptoms of depression with an itemized tool like the PHQ-9 or the QIDS, the Quick Inventory for Depressive Symptoms 9. I've had a particular interest in measuring cognition. And when I looked across the, I'll call it the grocery aisle of options, there wasn't a whole lot there that was user-friendly. There was products on the shelf, but, you know, most of us don't have time to conduct a three-hour neurocog evaluation, and this is not always available readily, and it's costly, and this is not really aligned with the type of ecosystem most of us work in. So our group, which is a large international group, has just recently validated a tool. It's called the Thinkit tool. It's phonetic, T-H-I-N-C-I-T, Thinkit. And 2 points. One is that you can just type it into Google and download it. It's free of charge. It'll be published in the Journal of Clinical Psychiatry, August of 2017. And the point is that this is a digitalized, patient-administered point-of-care tool that the patient's completed in the waiting room, takes up maybe 10 minutes to do, and it'll give you a full composite of the patient's cognitive abilities. And this will obviate the need for a full comprehensive battery. So some might say, well, doesn't the PHQ-9 alone give me sufficient index or sufficient understanding of the patient's cognitive abilities? I would say it doesn't give you a comprehensive evaluation of the patient's cognitive abilities. The PHQ-9 includes items, but doesn't give sufficient complexity in terms of understanding cognition. So we measure both, and because both are self-administered, the patient can do this in all about 10 minutes in the waiting room. As far as biological tests are concerned, or biomarkers or gene tests, let's keep going, MRIs or PET scans and so on, for now, what I can say, these are looking promising, but nothing's ready for the prime time. So we don't really have any laboratory test or other biomarker-type approaches that would establish the diagnosis of cognitive impairment. Now, I'm speaking very differently in the situation where somebody, let's say there's a query, the person has a neurological problem, let's say they have a space-occupying lesion in their brain, they've got localizing neurologic signs. Of course, an MRI scan would be warranted in such a situation. We're not talking about that. We're talking about a relatively common representative situation where someone is coming in, they're depressed, otherwise physically healthy for the most part, and there's no reason to assume that there's been, you know, a concurrent neurological problem that would warrant an MRI. There's really no place still in our assessment of their depression and their cognitive functions as to whether or not, you know, an MRI should be useful. It's certainly not warranted. We wouldn't do it. And wouldn't do an EEG or the blood test. Now, for patients, in fact, who come in, as part of just the standard workup, of course, we check them for their thyroid, we check metabolic parameters and other sort of organs like, you know, the kidneys and liver. But as far as cognition specifically is concerned, there's no specific biological test.
Very good. Now, before we go on, I want to remind our listeners that Vital Minds is a podcast series of the PA Foundation, a national nonprofit organization that promotes improvement in health and wellness by providing PAs and PA students with philanthropic opportunities and resources. All right, Roger, now let's turn to treatment. Now, what innovations have you seen over the recent years that are really changing the way we treat or approach mood disorders with our patients?
Well, I think the most innovative, conceptual or maybe philosophical, or you could even say strategic, maybe all the above approaches, is the wish to try and prevent the onset of depression. And like most areas of chronic disease, I think we prefer prevention than treatment. And the word prevention has not been put forward or bandied about as much in psychiatry as it should have. It certainly is in other areas of medicine. And yes, we can prevent depression. For example, we know that in postpartum women, some of the psychosocial interventions that are put in place immediately after birth of the child have been demonstrated to reduce the risk of depression. That's really, really interesting. It's not only in the psychosocial realm. For example, we are also, in fact, now in some cases using antidepressants to prevent depression. People might be saying, what did he just say? Antidepressants to prevent depression. Yeah, that's what I said. In the sense that we now know, and this is not uncommon, when we see hepatitis C patients who've got that infection in the liver, they often receive interferon-based treatments. That's a standard treatment for hepatitis C. And it looks as though interferon might be one of the most depression-causing drugs we have. Up to 30 to 50% of persons who receive that treatment become depressed. And when you pre-treat somebody with an antidepressant, you can cut that risk right in half. And we do this not uncommonly. So these are people who've never had depression before, but they don't want it, obviously. And they can reduce the risk in it by half if they take the antidepressant. So, and there's other examples, but I think the point is prevention. And we can take this in the public square. We now know that if you really carefully treat diabetes, well, you can prevent some of the problems like heart disease and so on. There's now very nice evidence saying if you can really carefully treat diabetes, you may be able to prevent depression. So the point is prevention is really one of the more changes we're looking at. Moving into people who have depression, some of the changes I think that have really emerged is the shift towards thinking about depression more dimensionally. In other words, we have often just taken depression and we put it into one bucket. It's just one entity. But that clearly is not true. Depression is a syndrome, and it's comprised of many different pieces. So I often use the example of metabolic syndrome. So people with metabolic syndrome, they have overweight, their blood pressure is elevated, their lipids are dysregulated, their sugar is dysregulated. These are obviously related, but they're very different. And depression has related symptoms, but different. And the field is moving towards looking at dimension. So thinking about, as we talked about, cognition, or talking about anhedonia, the absence of pleasure, talking about chronobiology or sleep and daily rhythms. These and others are the essential features of depression, but they can be sussed out and be very different. And there's an attempt to try and, yes, understand their mechanisms, but also treat them. And I think this is happening informally, but treat them more dimensionally. Now getting to some of the sort of nitty-gritty, what I've been really impressed with in terms of the pharmacotherapies, we have now some interest in ketamine and so-called glutamate-based treatments. The promise of these treatments is that they may be able to offer symptom relief within 1 to 2 days rather than the 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks that we've been seeing with conventional antidepressants. So so-called rapid onset antidepressants is looking very exciting. Of course, that's still to be determined, but what's there looks promising. We look forward to seeing some final results because we've all become familiar with the delayed onset treatments, and that's certainly something that has been frustrating and something we wanted to improve upon. And then we move into the area of some of the newer treatment approaches, and I had hinted at this earlier, some very interesting data now using what we call a repurposing approach. In other words, taking medicines that are already indicated for condition X, Y, or Z, repurposing them as antidepressants. So, for example, we're looking at anti-inflammatory treatments as potential treatments for depression. We're looking at some of the diabetes drugs as potential treatments for depression. And people who may not have an indication or a condition wherein those drugs have been more, usually thought about, that's a work in progress. If I move away from pharmacotherapy and think about psychosocial treatments, things I think are really exciting is an issue that deals with the access piece, and that's internet-based or computer-based cognitive behavioral therapies or other psychosocial interventions. Many of us work in parts of the country. I work in an urban center, and supposedly we are surplus with all kinds of resources, but I can't get a cognitive behavioral therapist for my patients. So internet, and of course, if you move into smaller centers, situations are more dire. So in fact, patients can access in a very private way. This is obviously very stigmatizing for a lot of patients to see a therapist. And it can be much more affordable to have internet-based CBT, which looks and is about as effective as seeing a live therapist. That's really exciting. And then finally, this I'm not covering all the bases, but just ones that stand out immediately, is the aerobic exercise and aspects around aerobic exercise and its role in treating, maybe not as a primary intervention, but as an important supportive role in treating depressive symptoms. Now, no one's going to be surprised to hear that exercise is good for your general health. That's kind of an obvious remark. But it is, in fact, looking as though that as far as the brain's concerned, exercise, resistance, and aerobic have very, very beneficial, probably multiplicative beneficial effect on brain. And this is not just some kind of just general well-being recommendation, but it may be, in fact, something that should be systematically considered for patients. And in fact, the Florida Medicaid guidelines for major depressive disorder, which will be published in the Journal of Clinical Psychiatry in August of 2017, are in fact listing aerobic exercise as a bona fide, yet to be fully established, but certainly very promising approach as an adjunct in the treatment of major depressive disorder. So I think that looks pretty exciting as well.
Now, finally, for the PA students listening in, can you draw from your experience in mood disorders and leave us with a single piece of advice?
I think that my advice to all the students would be that persons who you have an index of suspicion may have depression should be screened, carefully screened for depression. And if the diagnosis is made, these persons should be offered treatments that have the greatest therapeutic potential at the start. And why I'm saying this, that is, let's get this illness screened, diagnosed, and aggressively treat it right away, is that this can be a progressive illness, and too often we are, frankly, a little bit laissez-faire in how we're approaching the illness out of the gate. And there's so much morbidity and mortality linked to depression, this progressive, chronic, life-shortening illness, that can be absolutely prevented if we would have been much more attentive earlier on. So I think we really want to be on this as soon as it declares itself early in the illness course.
Well, very good, Roger. This has been incredibly informative. Thank you so much for your perspective on the issue and giving us your advice and some of your tips for the future generations of PAs here.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me indeed.
For those of you listening in, feel free to swing by the PA Foundation website for Roger's recommended resources on major depressive disorder and bipolar disorder. For that information and to find every episode of Vital Minds, we encourage all of you to visit our website at pa-foundation.org. And support for this episode of Vital Minds is provided by Takeda Pharmaceuticals USA Incorporated. Until next time, I'm James Millward, and this is Vital Minds.